Since Benfold 5 exploded in 95, fans have learnt a lot about the man behind the piano through his honest songwriting. But now, Benfold has laid his story even more bare in his book, A Dream About Lightning Bugs. It's an incredible look at his successes, his stumbles and falls that have brought him here to us today. Good morning, Benfold.
Good morning.
It's fantastic to have you here, mate. Now, first of all, congratulations on the book. Crystal and I have both absolutely
smashed it through this week.
From an outsider's point of view, your songwriting has always had an honest bent to it. You've always told stories through your songs. How does that then affect your approach to honest book writing? Is it much the same process?
It is, and in fact, I felt the success of the book, not commercially, but as a good book or a bad book, would hinge on whether or not it was honest. Since I'm trying to explain the virtues of honesty in art, it would be pretty tough if I were terribly evasive in the piece. And I'll be the first to admit, I mainly just want to write a good song, and I mainly wanted to write a good book when I set out in this. And if I have to abuse a little honesty and indulge in a little emotional lewdness, then I'll do it to make it feel right, to make it feel real.
Yeah. Is it difficult? Because obviously when you write a book, you have to go through an editing process and you have people telling you to cut things out or to tweak things. And of course, this is a story about your life. So is it kind of personal taking that?
I approach writing songs and then writing this book, oddly at some distance.
Yeah.
You know, I do. If an editor is not understanding where I'm coming from, or if I say something that doesn't strike them the way that I said it, then of course I know I have a problem, and I have to address it. I actually had to go ahead and insist a couple times that my editor take the gloves off.
Yeah,
let's beat this thing up. Why would I want something out there that had problems in it? My main thing was subtractive. Like, I wanted to continue to cut. So this was 140,000 word manuscript before I cut it down to 75,000.
Oh, yikes.
Oh, wow.
We lost half the story.
Yeah.
We lost half the book.
We need
but
an abridged version.
I don't think so. I think that's like when you can state something. I'm of a real, I call it lowbrow. I don't mean to undersell myself, but I do believe it's lowbrow. Mm-hmm. I think I know what side of the track I come from as a person and an artist. And I'm of the mind that you should state things as clearly as possible. Mm-hmm. I think in music you should state it as clearly as possible. You're trying to communicate. And poetry is not there to obscure. The poetry is there to illuminate.
Yeah.
And I'm an anti-snob when it comes to music, which is why I want all of my music audience to go enjoy the symphony orchestra. Not to show them how highfalutin I am and uppity. I want them to enjoy the simple beauty of the statement and the communication that's in it.
Yeah.
I don't think it should just be for snobs and upper class. I think it should be for everybody.
Sure.
So you've performed for decades now.
Yeah.
And with your honesty in your songwriting, you know, you've told these stories thousands of times across the world. And now you're getting a chance to flesh out some of the stories behind the songs. Now you have different stories to tell. How are people reacting that have maybe heard themselves in a song, but now they're getting the story laid bare as well?
I had the best comment on my book, for instance, from one of my oldest friends, who I value her the way she sees writing and art more than anyone that I know. Mm-hmm. Or as much as anyone I know. I mean, highly, let's say that. And because she's a great writer herself. Known her since I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
She's in the book. Her name is Anna. We were married. Mm. She said of the book that, first of all, she loved it, which is a relief, because when you write a song or a book and someone's in it, you hope they don't hate your guts for it. She said, how did she state this? It was really funny. She said, the book is incredibly truthful and true.
Yeah.
It's not always entirely accurate, which are two separate things.
Did she punch you in the jaw?
She did punch me in the jaw.
Okay, good.
Which is something that she didn't remember the same way as I did.
Uh-huh.
I stand by my memory of it.
Yeah.
But she said, explain that to your fact checker, that it's both truthful and not always accurate.
Yeah.
In fact, she implied that higher accuracy might have been less truthful, because any lawyer knows you can, you know, you can frame anything you want to make it seem different by omission. But no, I feel it's all very, very true, all vetted. I know everyone has different memories of things, but my point wasn't so much to tell my story as my point was to try to fill in a story of creativity that other people could take what they wanted from. You know, if I'm saying I listened to 8 hours of music on the floor when I was 2 years old, one person might take from it, wow, that's how he learned a lot about music when he was younger. Someone else might say, wow, that's obsessive.
Yeah.
So the two things, you take from it what you want. Can I say which one is more true? I can't. But I can suspect that it had an impact.
Yeah.
And so I write the story. If I had a great story, especially about celebrities, people I've known, things that might be a little more salacious, if those may be a value to sell a book, I didn't find any of it of value to tell the story of creativity. So I'm willing to sell a few fewer books and to explain something about creativity. I'm not concerned about that. This is not my day job. I just want to do it. I just want to make something that's honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's not only honest, but don't worry, it is actually really captivating to read.
Thank you.
There are so many incredible stories in it. And you do go back right to the start, you know, when you were saying how you listen to music 8 hours a day when you're young. There's also an incredible story about your dad being shot accidentally as a 22-year-old.
People have missed that one, which is interesting to me. You're the first person to ask me about that.
And the whole thing about using creative visualization.
Correct.
Do you want to talk us through that story?
Absolutely. No, I mean, it's an incredible story. I mean, you're talking about my father's side of the family. Most of them were illiterate.
Right.
They were from the mountains of West Virginia, coal mining place. I didn't harp on that as much as maybe I could, but the truth is, you know, his mother didn't have time. She was working two jobs, and boom, her son gets shot when he's 15 years old out in the woods somewhere just outside of town. They actually printed in the paper that he had died.
The obituary went in.
That's
the
insane.
Obituary went in. Plus, they also said that it was suicide, which is interesting because anyone knows anything about a 22 rifle would know it's pretty damn hard to reach the trigger.
The long arm.
Yeah. They didn't think that through. They were just concerned this kid had died, I'm sure. But, you know, my grandmother came in. He was, I guess, at the equivalent of the ICU or whatever, wherever you are, and the kid's about to die.
Yep. Yeah.
And she had him imagine ants going down into his lungs, taking out the bad, coming down with good, taking out the bad, coming down with good. And she had him, she was sitting by his bed, giving him this image all night long. He was supposed to concentrate on it. Where did she learn that? God knows.
That's amazing.
And he did this. He said he could imagine them, all this army of ants going down. He wasn't supposed to keep 3/4 of his lungs.
No,
that's not what the doctor expected. And the doctor had just come back from Vietnam where he was patching up soldiers. So he had a lot more experience in gunshot victims than anyone could have. And in the morning, he was pretty stunned that they were going to be able to keep his lungs. Why? Maybe because he was healthy. But maybe it was because the power of the mind is something that we just still don't even really quite have a grasp on.
Yeah.
But the fact that his mother thought that. Funny thing is, his mother, my grandmother, later converted herself into the Mormon church.
Yeah.
She became a Mormon. And she later explained everything through the lens of religion.
So the story changed.
The story changed, but I heard the story change over my lifetime.
Yes.
Which is an interesting thing to take note of when you're writing a memoir full of memories that morph over your lifetime, because that's what a lifetime is. It's memories of memories. And, you know, you got to watch that.
I'm fascinated with the clarity of your stories from the start of the book when you were a child. So not only the obsessive listening to music, the competitive learning of songs because your babysitter couldn't play them.
That's right.
The way that you interacted with your music teachers of that time.
Yeah.
Do you put that down, that the clarity of your memories from that time, to music and the way that you've interacted with art over the years?
Yeah, and I just went ahead and quoted a study in the first, what I kind of consider the intro, which is the first chapter, that shows, and it's one of many, that shows that a musician's brain actually looks different under a brain scanner and actually looks different under under physical inspection of the brain for the mass of certain parts of it. That's a funny thing to write as a musician in your own book saying, hey, people, I got the big brain.
Yeah.
But it happens to be true, and the reason that I stated that is because I was pretty confident in a lot of my memories that I realized that a lot of my friends are not confident in. Most of my friends can't tell you with confidence details about 2 and 3 years old.
Yeah.
It's a suspicious claim to be making. But I wanted to get that out front that I have a very strong suspicion, especially checking this with my neurologist friends, that the associative nature of music and the extreme amount of music that I heard at a young age might have something to do with it.
Yeah.
The problem with that chapter was that it was so easy to present that chapter as almost a thesis, as a hypothesis that was supposed to inform the rest of the book. Like, this book is about memories and how big the brain is for a musician. So I had to really watch the tone and navigate that and why a lot of people have reviewed the book, reviewed a different version of the book. I was horrified at that first chapter, for instance, and the sequence of a couple chapters at the end, and I really worked those over again. So, like, for instance, when I'm talking to interviewers live about it, they're asking me questions in the book that they're not sure are still in the book because I changed it a lot. But, man, I'll scrap to the last minute. When's this published? Tomorrow at 5? Okay, I've got to 4. I've got a 4:30 to keep working on this thing.
Well, we've read this week's copy. I think we're all right.
We're okay.
Awesome.
There is actually one story that I am so glad is in our copy of the book. Whether it's in the others, don't know. But it is an incredible situation, a dangerous situation that you got into when you were wearing lederhosen.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you just tell us how that unfolded? Because it seems like it's straight out of a TV show or some kind of drama film.
Yeah, you know the show Drunk Histories?
Yeah, I love that show.
Yeah. Well, Derek, who makes the show, really wanted to make a sort of a Drunk History style
recollection of that story.
With me reading it, and I was going to be reading to him at bedtime, and he was going to be in bed with a little cap on. We couldn't find the budget to work Well, you know, like, book publishing doesn't have like 90s rock video budgets, and they didn't expect that would sell anything. So anyway, look, that was crazy. That was my gig. I'm playing German polkas on a digital keyboard, one of the first made. And when I was 17, 18 years old, I think I was 18. And you know, my car was real small. It didn't fit the stuff in it. So sometimes I would borrow my father's car so I could put some of my equipment in there. Mm. He didn't want me stopping anywhere near that restaurant because it was a dangerous part of town. My father worked there a lot. Yeah. He worked on construction sites over there. Did work for the city of Winston-Salem on low-income housing. Knew it was dangerous and was like, Benjamin, don't stop on that side of town. You're just going to get mugged. There are these cats that tell you that they're going to take you to Mount Airy, which was a local a mountain close by, and kill you and take your car. This is happening all the time. Be very careful. Hell, I pulled up in the middle of the night wearing lederhosen, and a guy jumped in my car. I didn't see him jump in the car. I saw him across the parking lot, and it's just like it said in the book. I started moving forward because before I even really noticed a guy was in my car. It was like they stunk, and I slammed on the brakes literally in the middle of the road. It was the middle of the night, so no one was anywhere near, and I looked, and my father had all this stuff in his. I knew it was there, like in the door. You know, it was a knife, a gun, a can of mace.
Nice.
You know, what do you like
the lineup?
Yeah,
like choose your weapon carefully, my son. And I didn't know how to use any of it. I mean, like, you know, there were guns all around the house when I was a kid, but I never really was interested in them. I was kind of scared of them. One of the truth, I was scared. I did a lot of sleepwalking, and I would walk out in the yard, or I would get, like, you know, turn the stereo on, or or pee on my father's foot in the middle of the night thinking it was a toy. Like, I did all kinds of crazy stuff. So I was afraid I'd go where the gun was. Yeah. What could a kid do with a gun? I was petrified of these things.
Terrifying.
Anyway, I chose the knife for the obvious reason that mace would spray in the car and hit me in the eyes.
Very logical.
The gun, I mean, come on. I was an idiot, but I knew better than to shoot someone in my car.
Yeah.
So there you go. I pulled out a knife. I weighed about 130 pounds, which is like, what, 8 stone or something like that. And just quivering like a leaf, I asked him to get out of my car, which he did. And I moved on. But crazy stuff happens to you when you're a kid, you know?
Well, crazy stuff kept happening to you. And I'm fascinated by the sliding doors conundrum of your story, because not only, you know, did you nearly get carjacked and taken to a remote neighborhood, there was the random beating ahead of your scholarship exam. The, you know, bouts of pneumonia and the different choices you made along the way not to go to Nirvana live in the Unplugged show. So do you ever look back, particularly writing down your story, and think, where was the other pathway? If I did that differently, if I didn't get randomly beaten and I stayed in university at that point, where does Ben Folds end up?
Well, I think the psyche of a risk taker is that you probably don't recognize the dangers on the other side of the sliding door. So I've had a history of risk taking, you know, which is, I have to say, significantly diminished since I've had kids.
Yep.
You know, that's gone down and down. What I try to do is, I think there's a Flaubert quote about being dangerous, being safe in your life so that you may be dangerous in your art. Mm. And I've tried to more take that on. I've tried to be like, you know, let's not freak the hell out in everyday life. Let's be steady. And that way I can take my risks, you know, in the art. I haven't looked at the other side of the sliding doors, because that's not what someone who takes risks does. It's a sort of denial that you jump into these things with a bit of an adrenaline, and then you go, oh, what could have happened? Mm-hmm. Things don't randomly happen to people. Mm-hmm. You're choosing a path, and my path was always like, what the hell? I'll stop in the bad neighborhood. What could possibly happen? My random path is, oh, I could be the entire polka band and play this cheesy instrument and put on the Lederhosen. I mean, I see choices. I believe seeing choices is it relates to the title of the book about seeing lightning bugs. I see choices in life where maybe a lot of people don't see those as options. You know, a lot of times an opportunity is right in front of your nose.
Yeah.
And in the book, I think I've come to the conclusion that my way of going about life is just to follow my interests. If it's interesting, I follow it. So you better have relatively untoxic interests, you know, because if your interest was like seeing some kind of, you know, a freak show or being interested in something that was sordid, then that could be a problem.
Yeah. Hashtag no regrets.
Yes.
Now, you famously document what must have been one of the most difficult experiences of your life through your song Brick.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that is too personal to document in a song? Is there anything that you draw the line at? Or is it just lay it all bare? It can all go out there.
No, I must have my pain barrier somewhere. Mm. And I am also oddly a private person.
Mm.
You wouldn't think so because I've just written my life story. and I've written things about my life. But as someone who's a mercenary wanting to write the most effective song that I could. Sometimes the most effective thing you can do is to really tell the truth.
Mm.
And that's not always comfortable to do that. But I'm willing to do it because it means a lot to me to write the best song that I can. So that's kind of what happens to me, is that I take a deep breath and I talk about something that I never would. Prior to the song, there were 10 years there where even my closest friends didn't know about that story.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't something I was dying to tell people, but I saw the opportunity to make the best song that I could.
So Whatever and Ever I'm In, Brick was on that album. Ben, you'd already had your, you know, hugely successful debut album, and your first Aussie TV experience came on the Midday Show. Now, I know you've told this story plenty of times. If people don't know, you came and performed on the Midday Show. You threw a stool at Jeff Harvey's piano. Jeff Harvey famously got pretty pissed at you.
Yeah.
My wondering is, who booked you on that show? Who thought that the midday show for, let's say, 40 plus, and that's conservative, was the right place for this three-piece band from the States?
That's a very conservative estimate by what I saw. Well, the answer to that was revealed to me just recently as I met the lady for the first time.
Did you?
Since then, when she was still working with Carrie Ann Kennerly, and I did the show that she's on,
Studio 10.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Reunited, and it felt so good. And she said, yeah, I booked you on the show. It's funny because I had speculated in one draft, in my 140,000-word draft. I began that chapter originally by speculating what it must have been like for the person who booked it.
Right.
You know, which is what you wondered.
Yeah.
And then as I was cutting it down to the bone, I realized there wasn't room in the book for speculation like that. As interesting as a framework as that might have been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But see, the cool thing about that is you came to it yourself, which is what I love about writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Leave a thing out. Let
That's
someone come to it
asked.
Because you do wonder about it. Yeah. Well, you know, she had been moved from another show where she was the hippest young booker person. They wanted to spice a midday show up some. And
well,
she certainly did that.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I had recalled that there was a nice lady with blonde hair who, when we got kicked out on the sidewalk, was kind enough to go back in and get some of our stuff to bring it out. And that was her, too.
What do you reckon your ratio to good piano stool throws to bad would be? You documented a couple of the bad ones. Do you reckon most of them have been good? 95%?
Almost. 98% were on. Amazingly on. I would climb up speaker stacks and throw a stool.
Javelin
style. One of them ended up being what framed the MTV Music News in the U.S., which was a total honor for it to go, MTV Music News, you heard it here first. Doom ba doom ba bum. Stool toss. Boom. And then hit the piano. Oh, I used to nail it. I don't know how. I mean, some of it was that we knew it was a stunt. And so since we knew that, my sound man invested in a trailer full of the lightest stools that they could find.
Cushiest, lightest.
You could throw them a long way. They were tightened so that the thing didn't fall off. You know, the notable ones that I regret, I put in the book,
Portugal story made me cringe. Oh,
I cringe still thinking about it. I cringed writing it. I cringed thinking about it. It's absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
I did want to let the promoter whose grandmother had loaned us the piano, and I ruined the keys on her old Steinway.
Mm.
I did want him to do this. Just beat my ass. I'll heal.
Yeah. Well, you did try to make amends for that.
I did. I bought a replacement piano,
which is good.
I've got to say that the luckiest from the album Rocking the Suburbs is my all-time favorite love song.
Thank you.
Alongside The Pretenders' Stand By You. I love that song.
Beautiful song.
Hey, Ben, she likes this other song. She wants to know
that.
That's okay. I don't feel she's been unfaithful to my song.
I mean, it's cool because, you know, it's modern age. But I will say that I think that those two songs, for me, have an element in common, and that is that they're quite raw in the lyric. So it's not all about just, you know, the prissy flower stuff. It's that real just sincerity and genuineness, like the verse that's about the elderly couple that pass away within a short space of time
of each other.
Is it something that you are conscious of trying to stay away from cheesy love songwriting?
Well, yeah. I mean, what I was looking at that moment was I was asked by a famous film director of pop movies to write a love song, essentially, you know, and I do think these things through.
Yeah.
I thought about it and I was like, no one in my generation, at least that's been cool or who has been maybe nuanced in their career. No one that I respected touched the love song with a 10-foot pole. Why might that be? Some of it is because love songs have a tendency to make a promise that they can't deliver on.
Yeah.
I think everyone can look at divorce statistics, and not just mine, and see that a long-term relationship is not exactly what the love song promises, right? So it seems that a love song, even though it's hopeful and it seems positive, is maybe inherently dishonest.
Yeah.
So I think that my generation was coming to terms with that flaw of the love song. But I was tasked with writing a love song, and damn it, I wanted to crack the code.
Yeah.
What I think I came to realize was that that it needed an element both of longevity, but also of the rawness and sadness of life.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I quite got there, but I think by recognizing that maybe the most romantic image that I could find was a 90-year-old couple who died within a week of each other, that to me was the missing link.
Yeah.
And so I exploited that in the song. I'm like I say, I'm a songwriter who wants to write the best song, and I want to do it in, you know, my forum or my venue in life is no different than, you know, like if it was Mozart or Beethoven. I'm saying there are many differences between me and them, not just this. Let's not put me in the same category. But as of their time period, you had to be bankrolled, and you made the music that was the popular music of the time, and you made stuff that people forgot, and you made stuff that people remembered, and you made a song, a piece maybe about the emperor or about the a bishop or
whoever's paying your bills.
Whoever's paying your bills. So I see the role of pop music the same way, and I see no reason we should be let off the hook when it comes to writing important stuff. I also think it's not my job to write something like the same way as I edited down the book to nothing.
Yeah.
You know, a song like The Luckiest is about getting down to the fewest chords possible. Yeah. The chords in the song mirror Pachelbel's canon in D. Mm. The reason is because it's supposed to allude to marriage and commitment, which the song is often associated with.
Yeah.
So my suggestion to the movie director was I'm putting this in D, just like Pachelbel's canon in D, which is an old piece, so it's public domain.
Yeah.
Let's segue that at the end title into Pachelbel's canon in D as the credits come up, and that was my idea. Funny thing is every once in a while a very snobby orchestra conductor will say, you do realize that you happen to have copied Pachelbel's canon in D. And I'm like, well, listen, bitch, I did that on purpose, you know, because I wanted to quote that.
Yeah.
And certainly that piece is probably quoting something else.
It's beautiful. And thank you for making me cry every time I hear
it. Oh, thank you.
Ben, we can't let you go without doing something that a punter did to you about a decade and a half ago at Vic Theatre in Chicago, and that's a mini Rock This Bitch.
Right.
We have an Angel Melody Horn here.
No,
now,
no.
You have played this before. I know you famously use it on the track Smoke or Whatever and Ever.
This is a melodic.
Now, if we were to just put you into a time in the book and you were just to provide a little bit of,
let's just say,
a scene-setting vibe for it, and I think the time that would be best would be the Lederhosen polka band that you played in to entertain.
It doesn't work.
Oh, the note doesn't work. Beautiful. Beautiful. Ben's new book, A Dream About Lightning Bugs, is out now and absolutely worth picking up. He's also touring his symphonic tour in Australia next year, Thursday the 19th of March at the Theberton Theatre with the Adelaide Symphony Orchestra. Get your tickets through ticketmaster.com.au. It has been an incredible pleasure for us. Thank you for joining us, Ben Folds.
Thank you very much.